And we are recording with the one, the only, Mr. Howard Bloom for episode 1008. And the first episode with you in my new studio. Not that you're physically here, so I guess that doesn't really matter. But Howard, do the introduction. Do the thing.
Well, okay. So my favorite quote, which I should never repeat myself because it sounds egocentric and narcissistic, is Channel 4 Britain, which said that Howard Bloom is the Sir Isaac Newton, Sigmund Freud, Charles Darwin, and Einstein of the 21st century. And I try to encompass as many fields of knowledge as I possibly can. I've been doing it since I was 10 years old and started in microbiology and theoretical physics. And the purpose of following all your curiosities at once, something I call omnology, is to be able to pull out and see the big picture, that the specialists who are tunneled like gophers in a landscape and can only see the dirt around them, it's to fly over all the gopher holes and see them as pixels in a larger landscape, a big picture. And that's what I've been doing. And I've been working on understanding the universe from the Big Bang to what's going on in our brains as we're having this conversation, since I was approximately 12 years old. And that's a long time by now.
And
And I'm the author of 7 books, and I'm working on my 8th. And I appear on 545 radio stations every Wednesday night at 1:06 in the morning on the highest rated overnight talk radio show in North America, Coast to Coast AM.
And you worked with Michael Jackson.
And I worked with, oh yes, I forgot about that. So at one point, I jumped ship from science in order to do what is called participant observer science, which is a name that the anthropologists who used to go visit a distant, very unlike us tribe and would blend into the tribe and would try to absorb the very feelings of the tribe. Margaret Mead, one of these anthropologists, was so successful in absorbing the Samoan culture. She was on the island of Samoa studying the local tribes, that they actually made her a tribal chief. And I did that with a field I knew nothing about, starting in about 1971, rock and roll. And for me, it was a perfect opportunity. I've been hunting not just for the details of the physical universe and cosmology and chemistry and things of that sort. I've been hunting for the ecstatic experience since I was 12 years old, because it is an aspect of the human experience that's profoundly important and hence needs to have a place in our science.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying you can do science via the ecstatic experience, the transcendent experience, but you have to be aware of the fact that this is a universe that can produce
it's
such that, an experience,
yeah,
with a brain that can, and a psyche that can produce that kind of experience. So I've been trying to hunt that down since I was 12. And I managed to, I stepped aside from my normal science to do almost 20 years of field work in a field I knew nothing about, popular culture. And in the process, I founded the biggest PR firm in the music industry. Talk about being made a chief in the tribe that you're studying. And I worked with Michael Jackson, Prince, Bob Marley, Bette Midler, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Kiss, Queen, Run DMC, Billy Joel, Billy Idol, Paul Simon, Peter Gabriel, David Byrne, ZZ Top, people like that. And it was an amazing experience, whether you're a scientist or not. But if you come at it from the perspective of omnology, trying to put together the big picture of the universe and everything that's in it, including the human experience, it is a phenomenal opportunity. No other, to the best of my knowledge, no other scientist has ever done a field expedition of this sort, ever.
Of the grand theory of it all, how it all...
Yeah, because when you're in rock and roll, here I was hunting for the gods inside of us, hunting for the ecstatic experience. And guess what happened when I went to my first Fleetwood Mac concert at Carnegie Hall in 1973? I suddenly realized I was in the land where the gods are. I suddenly saw the ecstatic experience take over an audience and the band on stage and meld them. And I had an experience I've almost certainly told you about in previous episodes. When I was 16,
the dancing.
Yeah, right. So I had an experience where I had an out-of-body experience, and I watched myself on a stage performing for an audience. And I saw that audience's energy, the individuals, coalesce into a big collective blob. And I saw that blob reach a pseudopod out to me and send its energy through me. And there I was on the ceiling watching this. And I saw that energy from the audience be transmogrified somewhere around my head and then flow back out again to the audience in a continuous reverberatory feedback loop. And when I was finished, something utterly bizarre happened. The kids in my high school hated me. But they surged down to the foot of the stage. They'd never done this before in my time in that high school. They surged down to the foot of the stage. They picked me up off the stage, and they carried me out of the auditorium on their shoulders and carried me all the way to the building up the hill where we had our classes, and then finally put me down. It was extraordinary. And Tommy, strange as it sounds, I didn't realize that this was the core of the ecstatic experience I had been seeking until about 3 years ago. I mean, yes, I use this all the time in working with my rock stars because it's what they go through. And pulling those gods inside that come to life only when you're on stage in front of an audience and introducing them to the hello, how are you, fine, thank you very much self, the conscious self, was one of my tasks. That's why I called what I invented, piece by piece, step by step, secular shamanism. So yes, I have worked with, plus I worked with the 11th president of India, with whom I partnered for 4 years on promoting solar power harvested in space and transmitted down to Earth, which would solve all, it would bring us to net zero. It would get rid of the use of all fossil fuels. And I'm still working, doing my best to have some influence, getting that idea across. And I worked with Buzz Aldrin, and I worked with all kinds of other people, Newt Gingrich of all people, and I'm a Democrat and a liberal. So I've had a lot of a big variety of unusual human experiences that add to what I am as a scientific thinker.
I think what you're talking about, omnology, it's I interviewed the author for former Secretary of Defense General Mattis for his book Call Sign Chaos. It's a former Marine named Bing West, and he has two quotes in that book that really got me thinking. And the first is, if you have not read hundreds of books, hundreds of historical books, you're functionally illiterate. And the second quote from General Mattis is, intuition is subconscious pattern recognition, nothing more, nothing less. And those really got me thinking, and this was about a year and a half ago. So starting in August 2021, I actually tried to like mechanize my intake of information, because I started thinking, the more I read, the more patterns I can recognize. Like, you know, when we fill out CAPTCHAs, you know, are you a robot, you know, click on all the stop signs, that's also being fed. There's a dual use. One, it's making sure you're a human, but they're also using your pattern recognition to feed into the mind of AI, whichever company's researching it,
right?
And so it kind of clicked. I remember I was on the treadmill one day and I was like, what if I just read hundreds of historical books, like not fiction, not, you know, sci-fi, just historical books? Would I start to be able to pick out patterns? And then like putting multiple cameras around a room to get a three-dimensional image, you don't want to put them all in one spot. You want to put them in as many different spots as you can and then fill in the spot. So I was like, it would need to be everything I could possibly learn. And since August 2021, I've gone through 85 nonfiction books, so a little over one a week. And how I do it is kind of what we're talking about before we start recording. And it's, you have to mechanize it, right? You can get, it's like going to the gym on the first day of the new year. Like you can do that. You can get an A on your first assignment. Like wait until you've been 3 months into the semester and you're hungover and you're like, yeah, I'll take a C. So I was like, I need to mechanize this. And so I only do an hour a day. I only do 1 hour of listening to an audiobook. I do it at 2x speed, so it's 2 hours, but I just do it an hour a day because I know I can do that hour, even if I'm depressed, even if I'm anxious, even if I haven't slept enough, even if I'm going and visiting family for Thanksgiving, even if I'm hungover, whatever, I know I can do the hour. And because of that, I've gone through more books in the last year and a half than I have gone through in the preceding three decades. And although I feel like I'm at the base of a mountain, I do feel like I'm starting to, you know, right now I'm reading books about silicon production and 5G towers designed in China. And 2 weeks ago I was, you know, reading about Krupp, the arm industry of Germany.
That's a great book, The Arms of Krupp.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fantastic. Yeah, of course you've read it. Yeah. And you go into that and it's wildly different things. And then you learn about the presence of glyphosate in our food, or you learn about, I don't know, the mafia, like the mafia in like New Jersey who would, you know, crush skulls and throw them in the marsh. Like, but the more you learn, and I think I'm probably still decades away from it, you start to get the 3D scan of it all. And what seems like disparate pieces, the arms of Krupp versus the history of silicon chips and Huawei, you actually start to notice these underlying veins. And then you actually start to notice just how limited the number of themes in the universe really are. Just like there's the four forces, right? Strong nuclear, weak nuclear, electromagnetic or electrostatic, and gravitational.
Electromagnetic.
You start to realize that there's only a handful of themes throughout history. And it's a lot of them are just cliches, right? Like early bird gets the worm, or, you know, nice guys finish last, or early to bed, early to rise, or a penny saved is a penny earned, or, you know, what goes around comes around, or whatever. You start to see these themes play out just through hundreds of books about history across centuries and continents. And it is a perhaps an arrogant thing to say, but I feel like I'm on the right path to getting some sort of understanding of how it all works. I think I'm decades away, but I think I'm on the right path. And the reason why I just said all of that is, so you have to break it down into, well, then how can you do it every day? Well, you have to set up a framework in order to, you're a vacuum. You've got to just absorb information. Or if you're working out, you got to go put 20 minutes in push-ups or whatever you're doing. Or if I'm doing a podcast, how do I get to episode 1008? You do 2 episodes a day for 3 years. That, and you brought it up and you read my mind. You said a theorem called expectancy, which I'm not sure if that's what this is or if it's just
expectancy theory. No, this is infrastructure of habit.
Infrastructure of habit.
Take on a new project. For example, when you start a new semester at school, you got all new classes, you've got all new teachers, and you have to invent a new way of marking out your day, a new series of
how to get through campus,
rituals, that include even basics like where the hell is this class?
Yeah.
What time is it again?
Yeah.
And you map out your day. So you and I both time things almost to the second and have, so we can cram as much stuff as possible into the day. And we start with a routine. I start in the morning. You start in the morning by walking the 3 minutes down to your gym. I start in the morning by doing 1,250 vibrational plankings, which is sure hell, Tommy. And then every next move of the day is planned out. Take all your pills, which for me takes almost a half an hour, and give yourself your shot. Go take a bath. Go to your little office setup next to the bed and map out what, look at all the notes that you've taken in the past 24 hours on things that if you didn't write them down immediately, you would have forgotten. And put them into the computer, primarily in the list of things to be done. by my assistant, send her a copy of the list of stuff for her, call her on the phone, have her read me the stuff that's on the list and explain anything that needs explaining. Go put 10 eggs, raw eggs, into a blender, get it frothy, drink it, and go back to sleep. And all that has to be done with enormous precision.
Mm-hmm.
Or I start losing time.
Yes.
And that's desperate, because when you lose time, you lose the ability to complete the things that you need to complete during the day. So you map things out down to, again, as I said, the second, the way that I do. That is infrastructure of habit. And we humans operate on two different infrastructures, at least. One is infrastructure of habit, the daily ritual, the ritual that carries us through the day. The second is infrastructure of fantasy, that which we imagine to be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And infrastructure of fantasy is in, I think, The Genius of the Beast. And it gives the example of the fact that in just after the Civil War in France, I mean, the Civil War in America, but in France, there was a part-time stockbroker. And he really wanted to be a great author. And so he came up with an idea. There had been talk during the Civil War of reviving an old canon style. And it was this huge, huge canon that could fling an object that made cannonballs look like split peas. He took that idea a step further and imagined that you could build one of those cannons and put a carriage in the mouth. And then you could fire that carriage into the sky and fire it to the moon. Now, look, if you had been this guy's wife or this guy's mother or father, you would have said, look, Jules, this is insane. You want to be like the great authors, who are guys who sketched out human character and the human condition. And yet you are writing about this silly canon idea, which is ridiculous, and you're going to expect people to buy that? I mean, give up on it, for God's sakes. Become a full-time stockbroker and make enough money to support your wife and kids. But no, that's not what Jules Verne did. He finished the book From Earth to the Moon, and he got it published. And it became the first classic in science fiction. So a bunch of kids grew up reading Jules Verne's book. He had created an infrastructure of fantasy. And so these kids read his book. One was Tsiolkovsky in Russia. One was Oberth in Germany. And that was the floor for their infrastructure of fantasy, what Jules Verne had mapped out. And each of them said, there's a better way to do this than using the cannon. Don't put the explosives in the mouth of a cannon. Put the explosives in the back of the carriage.
Mm-hmm.
And use something the Chinese invented in 1500, a rocket. And so they worked out what a space program could be like if you used rockets. So then came two kids who grew up reading Jules Verne, first stage of the infrastructure of fantasy, and Oberth and Tsiolkovsky, second stage of the infrastructure of fantasy. And they joined a rocket club in Germany and started obsessively making rockets, amateur rockets. And one of them imagined what could happen if he all of a sudden got a whole mess of money and how he could build big rockets. And he lucked out. In 1933, a new head took over Germany. And when England, which he thought were his brethren, who would gladly fold in with his movement and join him as allies, when England refused him, he wanted to wipe out London. And he wasn't going to be able to do it with bombers. So he turned to this kid in the German rocket club and gave him a huge budget to make the rocket of his dreams, the V2 rocket, which started raining thousands of pounds of explosives on London. But the guy who was doing this had bigger dreams in mind. So when the Americans, when the war was ending and Germany was losing, and the Americans were closing in on Peenemünde from one side, and the Russians were closing in on Peenemünde from the other side, he had to make up his mind. Who did he want to be captured by, the Russians or the Americans? So he put his brother on a bicycle, and his brother rode the bicycle down the hill to the first tank unit that he could find of Americans. And he basically said a line that would become famous in science fiction, used in science fiction for the next 40 years. Take me to your leader. He said, I want to see General Eisenhower. Well, that wasn't going to happen. Nonetheless, Wernher von Braun surrendered to the Americans. And Wernher von Braun built the third layer on the infrastructure of fantasy. In the early 1950s, there was a guy who used to feed, he was a commercial artist in something like Kansas City. And a mouse would visit him at lunch, and he was very lonely at lunch. And if he fed the mouse would hang around with him. And he became an animator. And he made the first talking animation. And his name was Walt Disney. And Disney said, look, there's this new network called ABC, said this to Wernher von Braun. And they've given me an hour slot in prime time on Sunday night. I want you to put together a segment for my show. And that was terrific for Wernher von Braun, because he had all of these images. He had worked with a guy named Chesley Bonestell, who was a set design, a set painter, who also designed the facade for the Chrysler Building, one of the most unusual facades for a skyscraper ever. And Chesley Bonestell really wanted to do space art. So Wernher von Braun gave his ideas to Chesley Bonestell, and Chesley Bonestell illustrated them in a series of four amazing books. And now von Braun was going to be able to take this entire space program, including a space station that revolved, that was a donut, like a donut, that you would see in later in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And he was able to hammer these home, not just with a book, not just with a series in Collier's Magazine, but with television. And by the way, it was through this that Tomorrowland, that Disney invented Tomorrowland, Disney and von Braun. So this is what an infrastructure of fantasy is about. But there's more than that. You wake up in the morning and expectancy theory says you have a bunch of expectations in your brain. And if you don't meet those expectations, you become frustrated and angry. If you can meet those expectations, then everything's normal. But normal means a set of expectations for your day. I will get up and have breakfast. That assumes, first of all, that you can, that you are alive the next morning, that you can do something that utterly defies one of the most basic rules of nature. I mean, this is a big fuck you to Mother Nature, that you can stand up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you've tried balancing a pencil on its tip. Yeah. It just doesn't work. But you do the pencil on its tip routine every day when you put your feet on the floor and get a stand up after being in bed. And that's the way you conduct your waking life, is defying gravity the way that a pencil can't. But you can, thanks to a set of software up here called your vestibular system. So if you suddenly discover you can't get up, that throws your day totally off. Then you have to, and if that's going to be permanent, then you have to reinvent your life. You have to reinvent your infrastructure of habit, which is what I did when I was stuck in bed for 15 years and had to reinvent my very concept of who in the world I was. And so I founded two international scientific groups, and I wrote three books while I was too weak to talk. 2 weeks to talk for 5 years and stuck in bed for 15 years. You have to, at certain points, if you run into a crisis, reinvent your infrastructure of habit. and you have to revise your expectations for yourself. So that's what our initial conversation got going in my particular head.
I think there's a kind of a beautiful imagery there. I mean, 2001: A Space Odyssey, right? It's picking up the tool, the bomb, 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 bomb. That's just us grabbing a fork every day. You don't even think about it.
Right.
It is the culmination of like of the ape. And to us, it's just like grabbing a spoon.
Right. And right now, under our very nose, Elon Musk is taking one element of that infrastructure fantasy and turning it into a reality. Now, look, the last week, NASA launched what it called
Artemis.
Its Artemis moon rocket. And its Artemis moon rocket is a Franken rocket. It can only carry, well, it's only designed really to carry two people to the moon. Two people. This ginormous rocket. It costs $4.1 billion per launch. Meanwhile, Elon Musk is working on a rocket that will carry a spaceship that will carry 100 passengers. Now, with the Artemis, the NASA rocket is not really a moon rocket. It cannot land on the moon. All it can do is orbit the moon. But Elon Musk's rocket with 100 passengers can land on the moon, can take off again, and can land passengers back here on Earth. And NASA is sort of shoving it to the side.
Yeah.
What Elon's doing is taking the infrastructure of fantasy that started with Jules Verne and is turning it into a reality.
Yes.
And once, Elon wants to be able to run three flights of the Starship, the 100-passenger vehicle, a day. He wants to mass produce these vehicles. So I believe he has 1,000, he wants to have 1,000 of them. So his whole design of his factory and of the product, the Starship, it's designed for mass production.
Mm-hmm.
And once the Starship becomes ordinary and access to space becomes far, far more available to people, to human beings, our infrastructure of fantasy is going to use that as a floor. The way Jules Verne used the Columbiad, the cannon, the giant cannon, as a floor. And standing on that floor, it's going to reach to new heights.
And we're going to jump from there.
Right. So we have sort of the public expectancy, which is contained in the infrastructure of fantasy. And without an infrastructure of fantasy, a civilization perishes. Without a vision of a paradise toward which we are trying to take all mankind and liberate and free all humans on Earth, without that vision of a paradise, our civilization no longer has a reason for being and begins to shrivel, or, as Proverbs put it, without a vision, a people shall perish.
That the what's the quote? That which is now proven was once only imagined.
Right. And by the way, one little more note.
Sure.
Elon Musk wants to get the cost of the Starship, of a single Starship launch, to $2 million. What would that mean? Well, right now, we can only afford to launch the Orion once a year or once every 2 years. The Orion's the name of the capsule. We can only afford to launch the Artemis moon rocket once every 1 or 2 years because it costs $4.1 billion. For the price of one Artemis launch, you could buy 2,000 Starship launches. 2,000. Now, let's imagine that Elon is wildly optimistic about his $2 million figure, and it comes in at twice that, $4 million. Okay, then for the price of one Artemis moon rocket launch, which isn't a moon rocket, you can have 2,000 or 1,000 launches of the Starship, which is a moon rocket and a Mars rocket. It was specifically designed for Elon's long-term goal, which is to build a city on Mars in his lifetime.
And when it seems, because like we're at an interesting point right now where specifically us, we are looking at it and it seems absurd, right? The animations of 1,000 starships going to Mars. It just seems, you're like, what are you even talking about? Like, but you have to look back to just, this is what I always look back to when I try to, when I look at like my own goals and I think it just seems too fantasy-like. I mean, truly, you have to think about the Wright brothers in 3-piece suits on a plane that looks like it was made of particle board with like a canoe engine. And it's that would, versus like, if I wanted to, I don't know, I have to find which airport, probably LAX or like, or JFK. I could go buy for a reasonable amount of money a ticket on a double decker 4-engine Airbus A380 and fly all the way to the World Cup in Qatar and watch a movie and have a couple nice meals and ogle right. a flight attendant. That's absurd. That's 120 years. And
right.
this little science fair, you know, Kitty Hawk Wright flyer to a mass produced, not a marvel of the world, a mass produced Airbus A380.
Right.
Why can't that happen again? Why can't
well,
it?
Well, here, I love this particular example of how an infrastructure of fantasy works.
Yeah.
And the role that an achievement, the reification of something, making something real, plays a part. And so does human vision and human persistence. Once upon a time, there was a kid growing up on a farm in Illinois. And it was a rough life. He didn't have lighting in the house. He had to do all of his studying of books by firelight. But he turned out to be one of the most amazing scholars in the world. He absorbed books. Meanwhile, back in New York State, there was a governor, DeWitt Clinton, who had an absurd futuristic vision. The vision was, we had the Great Lakes and we had the Atlantic Ocean, but there was no way of communicating between the two of them on a reliable basis. He wanted to raise the money to build a canal that would connect the Great Lakes to the Atlantic Ocean. Now that seems, why even bother, for God's sakes? Why are you going to milk all this money from tens of thousands of New Yorkers in order to build this goddamn foolish canal? You're just trying to put your name on the map, literally. Well, once you had that canal, you could go up the canal from the Atlantic Ocean, from New York City, to the Great Lakes, and across all the Great Lakes to the Midwest. And in the Midwest, they were astonishingly capable of growing grain. Up until then, whenever Europe had a bad growing season, they had a famine. And thousands of people, if not tens of thousands of people, died. So they would have a stock market crash, they'd have an economic crash, but most important, there would be no food for lots of people. Well, once the Erie Canal was built and in operation, if people were about to starve in Europe, the Europeans could simply ship a bunch of gold over to the United States and buy a whole mess of wheat from states like Illinois, where this kid was growing up. So, and people wouldn't starve. So the idea of people starving during economic downturns has been obsolete for 150 years or so, a little bit more than that. Meanwhile, this kid, reading books by firelight, saw what DeWitt Clinton was doing, coming up with an astonishing dream to make transportation easier and bind the continent together, and wanted to do the same thing himself. And he wanted to do it with railroads. At that point, railroads only went up and down the East Coast. The furthest they got to the Midwest was Ohio, for God's sakes, which, as far as I'm concerned, is east. There was no such thing as railroads penetrating to the Midwest, much less the West Coast. And nonetheless, this kid dreamed of stretching a railroad so that it would go all the way across the country to California, this godforsaken area that we had acquired during the war with Mexico, that according to military experts on logistics, was worthless, had nothing but rattlesnakes and scorpions, was not worth putting a penny into. And so he became a railroad lawyer, the kid. And eventually he became president of the United States. And when he was president of the United States, he did what his role model, DeWitt Clinton, had done. And he began to pull together the money and the private enterprise needed to actually build a railroad that would cross the entire country, a transcontinental railroad. So a new technology, a new reality is the floor on which a kid just growing up stands and is able to reach out to the next impossible reality.
So there is also sort of like a moral obligation in which if you stood on the shoulders and you looked forward with imagination and you built upon the framework, it is your duty to put forward a fantastical new framework that you might not see completed so that the next person can stand on it. Because right now I'm using an Apple computer. I never met Steve Jobs. He never even heard of me. Right. But I'm using his stuff to interview you. So, and he's using electricity in me. He's out in California and he never had anything to do with the transcontinental railroads.
Right.
So like there is this sort of idea of you have to keep paying it forward, because the next person will stand on your shoulders, and there's a beautiful selflessness to it. Sure, you can slap your name on it. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. The ego pushes us forward, but there's a selflessness to it in that you're not going to see what comes next, but you do it anyway because you did see what happened in your own lifetime. There's not really a question in there. I'm kind of thinking aloud.
Well, yesterday, Reed Hastings, the founder of Netflix, said that Elon Musk is the most extraordinary visionary on planet Earth right now. I'm paraphrasing him.
Yeah.
Kara Swisher, who is a technology critic, has been doing a series of interviews on MSNBC and tearing Elon Musk apart. So have a lot of other people been tearing Elon Musk apart. And it's true. Musk has said some things that I don't like at all.
Sure.
Suggesting that the Russians and the Ukrainians sit down and negotiate, when the last time they did this in 2014, the Russians used it to take a big chunk of the Ukraine, and then only waited until they were ready to take the rest of the country. And when the common language on Russian TV right now, remember, Russian TV's personalities are all people who've been approved by Vladimir Putin, and everything they say has to fit within Vladimir Putin's accepted framework. And they are saying the Ukrainian language never existed. The Ukrainian people never existed. These are Russians. They speak Russia. And the Ukraine should be wiped clean of these appalling people who dare call themselves Ukrainians. And it should become part of the Ruski Mir, the Russian world. So they say should the Balkan countries, Poland, and in fact, Vladimir Putin mapped out all of his goals before he ever invaded the Ukraine. And it was to get all of Eastern Europe that the Soviet Union had possessed back. And then the guy he keeps around as a puppet to be president when he needs to be prime minister, or prime minister when he needs to be president, said, yes, we're after an empire that goes all the way from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, to Lisbon, in Portugal. So sitting down with these genocidal people, and giving up more of your country in order to get peace, you're not going to get peace. You're not going to get peace any more than you got peace in 2014.
Or 1939.
So Elon Musk's comment is, how can I put this? He's poorly educated on the subject.
Sure.
He doesn't know what he's talking about.
That's
now,
also
one of the charms of Elon Musk's Twitter feed has always been that he's just another human like us.
Sure.
And he'll say things on which he's poorly informed. But he just says things. He doesn't put himself forth as this giant who's bigger than you and me on Twitter. He puts himself as a person who's on your level and mine and shares his thoughts. He doesn't act the way a CEO is supposed to act. If he did, he'd never be able to achieve the 100 passenger starship.
He wouldn't be Elon Musk. He would be.
Right. And I'm a Democrat, and I think Joe Biden has accomplished some astonishing things, things that people on the Democratic side said he could never achieve.
The CHIP Act, the CHIPS.
Yeah, the three acts, the subsidization of the American people to get them through COVID, a stimulus act. I forget what the second one was. A third one now. I mean, he's gotten across four major deals, and everybody said he would never be able to get anything through because the Senate was so narrowly divided, and so was the Congress. And yet he's gotten these astonishing things through. No Democratic president has done this, or no president at all since Lyndon Johnson. And that was a long time ago.
Great society.
But I get furious. I got furious at Biden when Elon Musk sent up the first Dragon crew capsule and took four Americans to the International Space Station. It was the first time America had been able to take Americans on American vehicles to the International Space Station. And Biden refused to recognize this astonishing accomplishment as a contribution to America. And then Biden did a conference of some sort, a gathering on electric vehicles.
Oh, yeah.
And he brought in Ford and he brought in a GM and he brought in probably Chrysler, but he did not invite Elon Musk, who single-handedly has laid the base for electric vehicles all over the world.
He put in a framework.
Yeah, exactly. And is continuing to be the largest producer and seller of electric vehicles, the man who popularized electric vehicles. So you have to recognize your genius visionaries when they arrive. You have to recognize your DeWitt Clintons. You have to recognize your Wernher von Braun's. These are people without whom we would not have an infrastructure of fantasy and a path to turning that infrastructure of fantasy into a daily, everyday reality, like a trip to Dubai to see the World Cup.
Or much like standing upright to just walk into your kitchen.
Yeah, exactly.
I was listening to some comedian of all people say it, but he goes, we have this idea that just because Carnegie and Rockefeller did what they did, that it would have happened regardless. That's not true.
No.
They didn't.
No, there. Every once in a while, there is a human who is a light to all mankind.
Yes.
And that very seldom happens. And once one of those comes along, you have to cherish him or her. Instead, Elon Musk is being stoned on a daily basis. And nobody knows where the direction he's going to take Twitter. No, we do know. WeChat in China.
Uh-huh.
People live on WeChat.
Yeah.
WeChat started out as a messaging app like Twitter. And then it expanded. And it became like PayPal. And you could pay people on WeChat. And then it became, God knows, like your personal secretary, because you could set up appointments on WeChat. And now it's down to the point where it said that people live on WeChat. Well, that's the kind of grander vision that Elon Musk has for Twitter. In his view, Twitter has stagnated by not advancing toward these higher goals. And, you know, once you've achieved what WeChat has achieved in China, once you've climbed the shoulders of a giant, then you have to do what the giant did. You have to take it to the next level.
Yes.
And Elon Musk has uniquely demonstrated that he is capable of doing such things. Now, whether he will be able to do it with Twitter, we do not know. Look at Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos has achieved something astonishing and utterly transformed the way you and I shop. And when we had 3 years of shutdown for COVID, we could still order anything we wanted and have it there within 24 hours. So it became a necessary foundation for the lifestyle we had to invent to get through the COVID crisis.
And even after COVID, most of the stuff in this studio was from Amazon during COVID.
Right. So even after the COVID crisis, our habits, our daily infrastructure of habit has been utterly changed by Amazon. So Jeff Bezos thought that he was capable of creating a business structure that could do anything. And his dream, since he was a child, since he was a teenager, has been to put humans in space. Take all of the industry on Earth, put it in space where it can't pollute anything, and turn Earth green and fertile and a great place for humans and for the rest of life. So when he resigned his position at Amazon, he stepped over to his space company, Blue Origin. And Blue Origin has been flying one rickety-tickety Mickey Mouse rocket, and it's taken people to space. No, it's taken people to the edge of space for a few minutes, and that's it. And his rocket to compete with Elon's rockets is something called the New Glenn.
Yeah.
Have we seen hide or tail of the New Glenn in the 3 years or so since Jeff Bezos left Amazon and took on this task? No, not a thing. With great difficulty, he delivered two engines to United Launch Alliance. Well, great. Elon is producing 50 engines a month or something like that. And producing two engines took Jeff Bezos something like 5 years. And now we don't know if those engines are like Elon's, designed for mass production, or if they're ricky-ticky little engines that engineers had to put together piece by piece by piece by hand. If that's what they are, it'll take them another 2 years to deliver his next two engines. Now, we need Jeff Bezos to succeed. But if success were as easy as Elon Musk is making it look to be, then Jeff Bezos would be there too, and he's not, which means Elon is not just unique in his ability to dream. He is unique in his ability to turn his dreams into everyday realities. The Falcon 9 rocket has flown somewhere around 110 to 120 times so far without any, I mean, he had his last failures in the early stages, and those are all behind him. And the Falcon 9 has become the most reliable space transport vehicle on Earth and in Earth's history. And that's Elon's machine. Now that he's working on the bigger machine, the 100-passenger device, we tend to forget about the Falcon, which is sometimes delivering two or three cargoes to space a week. But Elon wants them taking off daily.
And he had a quote, and he's never elaborated on it since. But this talk with you right now is kind of dusting off those brain cells. He said that his rockets planned for the far future, for beyond Mars. I think he said, we'll quote, make the BFR, the big fucking rocket, the 100-person rocket. Said the craft that he's designing They'll have to be constructed in space, and they will, quote, make the BFR look like a dinghy.
Oh, if you find that quote, send it to me.
I'll have to find it for you. He's talking about, like, actual starships. And who knows? That might just be, he's setting that up for the next Elon Musk.
Well, building a spaceship in space using space materials, you could make the thing 2 miles long.
Wouldn't matter.
Yeah, because there's no gravity up there.
There's no launch. There's no delta V you got to worry about.
Right.
You just had
exactly.
I think that's the idea, is to actually use the BFR as a dinghy. Use that
right.
as the oil tanker that doesn't actually hit the port. You would just go from here to Mars, and then you have something leave the ship and go to Mars. So this big thing would never need to land. You never need to worry about aerodynamics or delta V or Mach stem or whatever the hell.
Or taking a piece of building material and bringing it up to 30 feet off the ground, because there is no ground up there.
Doesn't matter.
And you can put anything anywhere you want on a construction project.
And it doesn't need to look like a plane, doesn't need to have rounded edges. It can look like a middle school erector set.
Yes,
doesn't matter.
Exactly.
No aerodynynamics. You can hurl that baby. Doesn't matter.
Well, one little more detail on Elon, and it's very important to understand. This is a man not just with vision for what he can do in space, but with vision for humanity. In 2005, I was dragged out to a space conference. I did not want to go, but I was prevailed on by a friend at the National Science Foundation, by a friend at NASA, and by a bunch of people at the National Space Society. And so they got me to come out. I went out. I saw Elon Musk speak. I heard him say the following. When I got out of college, I asked what three things would do the most in my lifetime to change humanity. And the answer to that question was the internet, alternative energy, and space. And I went directly into the internet. So he built a payment
Zip
platform and sold it to PayPal, and then helped build PayPal into a major, major deal. Left PayPal with $1 billion, skipped alternative energy, although he's been involved with that, and went directly to space. And at the time, he was being mocked. He had not even launched a tin can with a firecracker. And NASA was scoffing that they knew how to do things, big engineering, and they knew how to do it safely. And nobody else, certainly not an amateur that they'd never heard of before, would ever be able to accomplish these things. I apparently have in my gut something that tells me when I'm in the presence of a superstar. And it went off for Chaka Khan. It went off for Joan Jett. It went off for Billy Idol. And it went off for Elon Musk, except the message it was delivering to me is not, this is a superstar. The message it was delivering is, this is a mythic personality.
Hmm.
Kids will be basing their lives on his life 110 years from now. And so I had four phone conversations with Elon Musk. And I had no idea why I was calling him, because this was a message from my gut that my verbal brain has not yet been able to articulate. So eventually it became clear the calls were a waste of his time and he had better things to do with his time. But Elon has lived up to that gut message. That this is a person whose life kids are going to be modeling themselves on 100. Now it's 100 or 95 years from now or something like that. So there is an underlying ethic and absolute determination to do something to expand the powers of your children and mine, or in my case, grandchildren, though I don't have any really. But that's what he's here for, and he knows it. And no one else that I've ever encountered, except Michael Jackson, has had that sense of commitment to a generation that hasn't been born.
Wow. That's, and again, it's for for all of his flaws and all the, and Elon Musk does have them, as do we all. You do kind of see that. I mean, by using internet based from space. Yeah, I mean, he is providing, for better or worse, I would say for better, an ability to speak and express yourself. How he's laying a framework for the framework of imagination, because
the infrastructure of fantasy.
Part of the infrastructure of fantasy is also having stupid ideas, myself right. included. But the thing is you have to cycle through them all to find the one that works. You gotta spin the wheel. You gotta spin the slot machine to see which ones work. You have to have this field of potentiality, which is Twitter from Starlink, and it can't be censored. Every idea has to get out, including the dumb ones. Hey, Ukraine, sit down with Russia. But that also means the next Elon Musk is gonna have an idea, and that open field of discussion will exist. And it will be for something that you and I, if we heard it, we'd probably scoff at, much like we are looking back now at the military generals and the logisticians who said California was worthless. Now California's got a bigger GDP than like most of the world.
Actually, it does have the world's biggest economy.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Point in my case in point, exhibit A.
Right.
Yeah, that.
Well,
that,
and remember, Elon is saving the Ukraine because the Russians have been practicing the art of electronic warfare for decades. And they thought they were going to be able to wipe out all internet connectivity in the Ukraine and render the Ukraine helpless. And along came Elon with Starlink and gave them the internet connectivity they use to pinpoint Russian troops and Russian big machinery like tanks. And they send their drones. The drones do reconnaissance using constant internet access. And then on the basis of the positioning, they aim their artillery. And they often wipe out that Russian equipment. So they're able to do this. I mean, when for a day their Starlink went out, they were in serious trouble.
Yeah.
Because in war, you need to be on top of things second by second by second. Mm-hmm. But Elon Starlink has saved them. Again, Joe Biden, my president, who I voted for and will vote for again in 2024, took away $1 billion that was supposed to go to Elon Musk to provide rural access to the internet and access for all of those who are internet deprived, and instead sent that money elsewhere. That is stupid. The justification seemed to be that signing up for Starlink costs too much money, and the people that Biden wanted to reach couldn't afford that. Well, if he's giving $1 billion, he can pay it through that $1 billion, for God's sakes. Nobody else has anything like Starlink. Starlink, the last time I counted, was well over 3,000 satellites. Nobody else on Earth has anything like that.
There's also a beauty in that. I've interviewed a Brandon Weikert several times. He's a great author, and his new book, Shadow War, about Iran. He talks about the misconceptions people have about Jimmy Carter. That's kind of, you know, spineless or limp. And they talk about like the speeches he went and gave in China and I think Iran, and talked in a way, or and as well as and I think Cuba, but the speeches he gave and was able to, without hesitation, denounce dictatorship and champion the liberties of a free society. And he was able to do so because, for lack of a better term, he had the big swinging dick of the U.S. military behind him.
Right.
There's also kind of that, you know, they're not going to let anything Elon touched, because he's the biggest contractor for the DOD, specifically for Space Force and Air Force Space Command, which I think has been merged with Space Force. But you can kind of see, like, coming from that projection of force, Russia's not going to touch a Starlink satellite.
Well, they're going to have a problem, because traditionally a satellite constellation has been a big deal if it has six satellites.
Oh, yeah.
Six satellites you can wipe out. The Chinese have had rockets
aimed
at our satellites
2008, right? That
for
test.
Roughly 10 years, just ready to take out our satellites, all of them, and render us flying. In one of the groups I run, we have the former governor of New York State, we have the former head of the House Science Committee, and we have a three-star general. And the three-star general says, if there's an alert, you're a pilot, and you're in an airbase, and there is an alert that you need to scramble immediately because there's incoming stuff, you can run out to the tarmac, jump into your cockpit, and try to turn the key, and nothing will happen. If you have no internet connectivity, your plane will not fly. In the days of six satellites being a big deal as a satellite constellation, that internet could be wiped out totally. Now that there are 3,000 satellites and Elon is aiming for 14,000 satellites, yeah, just try. You know, you might, with one of your explosive devices, take out two or three of these things, but we've got several thousand left. So the Starlink is exactly what the military would have wanted if it had the gall to dream.
To have the gall to dream. Yeah. Yeah, you have to harness that person.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And which means recognizing and showing admiration, giving credit to that person. Now, Elon seems to work very well without getting credit from the president of the United States, thank goodness. But it's meant he's gone a little wacky politically.
It'll get you.
He's gone to the right politically in a way that I, a Democrat, at least find disturbing and obnoxious.
Sure. But you got to almost wonder, is this a necessary, if you and I, because right now we look back at Carnegie, Rockefeller, whoever, and we see them in the neat, concise, bookended history. Maybe in 200 years, we'll be looking back at Elon and they'll be going, and it will be like an accepted thing. Like, no, part of the efficacy of the genius is they don't get recognized. Maybe that's right. A fire. Maybe that's another fuel source to push
profit,
that.
Profit is without honor in his own land.
Maybe there's just, that's that extra 1% that goes, I'm doing all this, and even the fucking president won't give me a high five. All right, I'm going to do even more. Maybe that's what you need. Maybe it's the cold father withholding approval. I don't know. I have no idea. And maybe it's not. Maybe he turns into a psychopath because of it. I have no idea. I'm not trying to stake a claim. But
wait, we're at 7-Eleven.
Yeah. I'm a horrible host. I kept you 11 minutes longer. I apologize for nothing. Howard, I truly adore talking to you. It gets me excited. It reminds me why I'm doing everything. I'm 32. I still have a life of plans ahead of me. And sometimes I get lost in it. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm doing a podcast. Like, why shouldn't I go get shit-faced tonight? And then I'm like, if I got shit-faced tonight, I couldn't work tomorrow. And I couldn't. And there's a value in that. We are playing a game where we get to contribute to the progress of humanity. That's not some Hallmark line. Like, we get to, whether you're contributing to a sail on a ship of the line or whether you're contributing to Starlink, like, you get to push this machine forward. It's the greatest video game that we could ever play. And today's talk definitely refreshed that in my mind, to constantly push towards improvement and evolution. And so for that, I thank you.
Well, a good statement. Next time I'll plug the Howard Bloom Institute and its Evolving Western Civilization Initiative, which is all about this.
Beautiful.
But that's for next time. Meanwhile, we got to send me back to work.
Beautiful. Yeah, we do. And it's 7:13. I'm 13 minutes over. I'm a horrible person. Unforgivable.
You're not a horrible person. We all think you're incredible.
Well, Howard, you know I love you. You're my honorary grandfather. And whether or not you accept that, I've already placed it on your shoulders.
I'll accept.
Beautiful.
With glee.
Yeah. Howard Bloom, I'll put the links to all of your stuff in the description, all your books, all your social media, all your websites. I'll email you this, and you find me a date for our next episode, and it's yours, and we will plan out that one, and I can't wait for it.
Hey, terrific. So I'll see you again soon.
Yes, sir. Mr. Howard Bloom, I love you, brother. Thank you so much. God bless everybody. Stay safe. The one and only.